Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English head.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And just in case you're wondering, today is Saturday, like all of our shows. But this one is on July 20th. So if it's July 20th where you are,
that is here, too.
Right. You are welcome to give us a call in here at KTEM. The telephone numbers are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And I said I was going to talk about Detroit.
Yes.
Which a lot of songs have been sung about.
There's a whole group of people that sang there.
Motown.
The Motowns,
yeah.
Yes. The Motor City.
I don't think Motown is actually in Detroit anymore.
I don't know. I know it used to be.
Home folks think I'm big in Detroit City. See, that's the way it goes. Yeah, well, you don't have to be much to be big in Detroit City anymore.
There's not much left in Detroit City anymore.
As the Up and Down Wall Street, which normally is sort of a tongue-in-cheek, semi-humorous column, stated in Barron's this week, while the major stock market averages reached new highs and Moody's Investment Service raised its outlook for its AAA rating for the U.S. government, the city of Detroit filed for the largest municipal bankruptcy in history. So that's worth taking a look at, because Detroit is not the only place in the country that's looking at this. And as the article goes on to point out, Detroit is obviously a one-off situation. We don't actually, there have been several cities in the United States that have filed for bankruptcy besides Detroit. However, there's something different here. The state of Michigan did not step in and rescue Detroit. They did actually a little bit for a while, but they have backed off. And one of the things that, the reason I was mentioning the Maryland Pension Fund a little earlier is because if you contrast Detroit's methodology of funding the pensions of its municipal workers with the way that Maryland, and for that matter Texas, is funding the pensions of their municipal workers, there is such a world of difference that it's shocking. Mm-hmm. And the world of difference comes down to the fact that in Maryland, the investments made 10.6% over the last 12 months. In Detroit, years ago, and you have to have been around for quite a while, it's not mentioned in the article. All that's mentioned in the article about Detroit is the fact that, and I've listened to this on the radio yesterday, the people who had pensions in Detroit are pretty much out of luck, because this is the weird thing.
Yeah.
Detroit was not covered by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Association, which is a federally chartered organization.
It's there to protect pension holders, yeah.
And you know, as a municipality, they could opt out, just like a school system can opt out of Social Security. And there's a lot of pension holders who considered themselves years ago to be completely secure because they were on a government pension and they're retired. It's going to be a really interesting debate, and it's going to be a really interesting, from our perspective, court case, because the bankruptcy of Detroit is going to set a precedent in federal bankruptcy proceedings. And the precedent is going to be based on something very interesting. Are the bondholders first in line to collect money, or are the pension holders first in line to collect money when a major metropolitan area fails? Because the point is, the fellow who's in charge, he was placed in charge by the state. He's not the mayor. He was just basically, he's sort of a bankruptcy trustee.
Right.
Has said he wants to just divide it up pro rata among everybody that Detroit owes money to, and nobody is in first place, whether you are a bondholder or you are a person who has been supplying electricity to the city or a company, or whether you're a pension fund holder. And oddly enough, no one has ever proposed such a thing before.
Right. And this is an important statement here. Generally speaking, when we talk about debts, some people stand first in line, some people stand last in line. If you think about, you know, the program before our program, when they talk about bankruptcy a lot. And, for instance, a credit card stands behind somebody that has a credit card bank, if you have debts to the bank, stands behind in line the person that has a loan to you for a car, because they can go and get your car.
Mm-hmm.
A credit card is generally considered an unsecured debt. When we talk about municipalities or corporations or anything else, unsecured debt generally stands at the back of the line, just like in your own bankruptcy if you were to have a bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit is working very hard to see if they can change that.
Well, actually, there's not a lot of security in their debt.
No, I mean, well, their municipal bonds were supposed to be secured based on the tax revenue of the city. However, the tax revenue of the city doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Nobody lives there. Everybody left.
Right.
So, I mean, the concept that they could just raise taxes on the people that live in Detroit, because Detroit's always going to be there, is a bad concept.
Right. And there's a lot of discussion I've read, particularly among people who sell bonds. Ha, what a coincidence.
Wow.
That, oh, don't worry about this. This is a one-time affair. It was telegraphed for decades. Everybody knew it was coming.
Yeah, no, they didn't.
You mean kind of like Illinois?
Wait a minute. Is that a country?
That is a state.
Oh, I thought we were talking about America.
The state of Illinois. America's actually in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
the state of Illinois is losing money hand over fist. They just got fined by the SEC for failure to disclose properly disclose the risks involved in borrowing money from them.
Right.
And in buying a municipal bond or a bond for the state of Illinois. Chicago, although it still has investment grade bonds, an unprecedented event occurred that is one of those little things that we look at and I focus on when I see them. When I see these things happen, and obviously you're not going to see it in the headlines of the local paper, but Moody's cut Detroit's credit rating by three.
Detroit or Chicago?
No, Chicago's credit rating by three notches.
That's a big deal.
Just cut it by three notches. Now, it's, you know, you say, well,
Chicago's not going to go anywhere. Well, this is the same kind of telegraphing that they're talking about with Detroit.
In other words, this is the point. Now, the way this stuff is worded, you miss it. For instance, Chicago had an AA3 rating. Now it's got A3.
Oh, well, what? There's letters and numbers in both of those
things.
And
you say, well, big deal, what's the difference?
There's
well,
just one A, and what is that?
Triple A.
No big deal.
In other words, AA3 is the highest rating you can get, but cutting them back to A3... which is actually three steps down, is a very unusual thing. And they turned the outlook to negative, which means we expect to cut again. Now, what does that mean? It means that the assumptions that a lot of us make with regard to investing are probably wrong. In other words, something that you think is safe, let's say you had purchased from the state of Illinois or Chicago, and a lot of people do, a municipal bond with a 30-year maturity. Those are very, very popular bonds. They have typically the highest interest rates. What people don't grasp when they purchase a 30-year municipal bond is that it's a 30-year
municipal bond.
Now, this is interesting. If interest rates go up, they can, if you had a high interest rate bond that you purchased from them, they in many cases have the ability to come back in a few years and say, no,
we don't want to buy that high interest
anymore. We're taking that back. And
that's the call.
Right.
They've called it back.
But you don't have the option to go back to them and say, whoa, interest rates have gone up. I believe I want to go buy another one someplace else. So why don't you give me my money back? Because they won't do that. And so you're stuck with that bond if you want to get that interest rate.
It's the same thing as when you go to the bank. If you go to the bank to get a mortgage and you say, all right, I want you to loan me money and the interest rate of the day is 10%. Okay, I want a mortgage at 10%. It's the lowest that's available. Please give it to me. So the bank says, here you go. Here's a 10% mortgage. And 5 years later, it is down to 6%. So you go to another bank or even this bank and you say, I want a loan for 6% to pay off the loan for 10%. So I don't have such a high loan anymore. The bank doesn't have a say in that. They don't say, no, you can't. Oh, I have a 30-year loan with you. That's the callback. We've called back that money from the mortgage. Nope, we don't want to do that anymore. But if the bank gives us a loan at 3% and 2 years later it's up at 9%, the bank can't say, well, we want that loan back.
I hate to tell you this, but they do that with me on a regular basis. Every 5 years.
You have a different kind of loan.
Well, it's a commercial loan, right. No, it's not an arm. It's a commercial loan that every five years they get to adjust the interest rate.
It's a farm. It's a five-year renewable farm.
But it's in commercial loans, by the way, they do that. But
yes.
By the way, that's a completely different area in this issue of abolishing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which has popped up in the House.
Everybody keeps talking about it.
Well, one of the things that I'm going to come back to Detroit, but one of the reasons that
it's all part of the same story.
I certainly do not want to see Freddie and Fannie completely abolished, and here's why.
I would like them to compete with each other, but...
Well, the point is, if you abolish them, what happens is the idea of being able to refinance your mortgage goes out the window because banks will then apply the same methodology to home mortgages that they do to commercial mortgages,
and that
will definitely hurt things. But let me get back to Detroit.
Yeah, we'll come back to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in a minute, then, because that's important.
The problem with Detroit's, I don't know if it's a problem, but the issue is that I think we're going to see a precedent probably established here. I think we're going to see the people with pensions get a significant cut. I think we're going to see the bondholders get a very significant cut. I think it's going to be as contentious over the next several years as was and is Greece's debt. But let me take that one step further. When you go out and buy an annuity, and I just talked to a guy about this yesterday who's a customer who's moving on to other things at this point, but he was talking about annuitizing an annuity that he owns. And what I told him was, you need to be very careful because let's say that you purchase an annuity and you live another 30 years. You have loaned your money to an insurance company with the hope and understanding that that insurance company will be solvent and able to pay you for 30 years into the future.
It's the same as a municipality, and only with a company.
Really fascinating. If you go back to 1990 and you look at the companies that were in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or you go back to 1980 or to 1970 and you look at the companies that were in the Dow Jones Industrial Average at that point, in many cases you won't recognize the names of the company because the companies no longer exist.
And those were the biggest companies in the world at the time.
They were considered to be the representatives of the market, the most financially stable companies.
Yeah,
Montgomery Ward is one of them. By the way, Montgomery Ward did not merge into anything.
It's gone.
It just vanished into bankruptcy. Nobody bought it. Its assets were sold off.
Yeah, Detroit is one of those easy moments in time here. We're going to be able to use this as an example. Detroit was considered to be the Iron Belt of the United States. I mean, this is where we had most of the thing that the United States was famed for all over the world. We have the industrial capability of the United States located in one town, and technology's changed. the way we create things is not the way we used to create things, and Detroit is stopping to be a city. I mean, there might be something there at some point, but it's not going to be what it used to be. They're talking about knocking down buildings all over the place because it's just this huge place with lots of empty houses. That's not good for anything.
And people say, well, that happened there, but it can't happen here. Locally, and I've been telling people this for some time, and yet it doesn't seem to have set in. I remember 1991, and in 1991, we had the end result of first one division being fundamentally abolished. The 2nd Armored Division was being stood down. That's an interesting term.
By division, you mean military division.
Military division. 1st Cavalry Division then deployed overseas. And every real estate, to the best of my knowledge, every rental facility, every apartment complex in the Killeen area went bankrupt. Now, there may be an exception to that someplace, but I don't know where it was. Almost all the banks failed in the Killeen area.
It was right in the middle of a bank and savings and loan failure all over the place, but Killeen was worse.
Killeen was the epicenter of this. And for many, many years, people have said, well, you know, we have Fort Hood. We have all these civil servants here. We have all these contractors here. And government money is a stable thing. Therefore, this is a stable economy. Let's not worry about it. We can buy municipal bonds here. We can buy real estate here and rent it out. Well, folks, right now, that's being called into serious question. I mean, very serious question. And yet, I still talk to people routinely who want to take their money and go buy a rental property here in the Central Texas area because of the steady stream of income that they've been told about that they get from the military personnel and the contractors.
Well, it's been steady since 1991.
Yeah.
This is...
But the point is diversification. What was it that the thing about, and it, I'm not the only person certainly to say this, John Templeton has said it, who many of you have never heard of now, but every major success in long-term investing has stated at some point, what is the best thing that I can do to protect myself and the portfolio? And I think it was, and I don't remember who specifically, I think it was John Templeton said, there's three things you can do that will make your portfolio much more predictable, much safer, and take you exactly in the right direction. And he said the three things are, and very carefully listen to me, he said, diversify, diversify, diversify.
Right. The counter to this, and I've heard this stated many times, is Mark Twain, who said, keep all your eggs in one basket, but watch that basket. Now, this is the counter by Mark Twain, and people go, yes, that's a really funny statement.
Keep your one egg in that basket.
He said, keep all your eggs in one basket, and then watch that basket. There's a problem, though, and one that is relatively unknown. People think, well, he's a brilliant man. He's got all these great quotes. These are things that are part of our lives on a day-to-day basis. He went bankrupt. He had to fund his bankruptcy with a book tour. All of those great witticisms that we think of when you think of Mark Twain didn't come from his books. It came from him going out and giving speeches, just like former presidents have, for great deals of money to pay off his bankruptcy because he kept all his eggs in one basket and watched the basket as it broke. So recognize that even the great Mark Twain had problems with diversification. It seems like a really simple concept, but Samuel Clemens didn't do so well. He followed his own advice and watched the basket as it broke, and so did all the eggs.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number is near 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Before this flood of calls. Yeah,
before we go to commercials, I wanted to mention Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
You did. So,
yes.
We can talk about that.
People that talk about abolishing them don't understand what they are. There was a time, and if you think back to the It's a Wonderful Life movie that we watch every Christmas, there was a time when if you wanted a loan on your house, you got it locally. And when you got that local loan, you were able to buy your house. It was a great thing. It was a very nice innovation, local savings and loans and local banks. There was a problem, however. In a small community, which most communities are small, the bank doesn't have a massive amount of money to move around. So I'm going to use some just basic, raw, generic numbers. If a bank is in a local community and they're a fairly decent size, not huge, but decent size bank, they generally have about $50 million in deposits. And they have to loan some of that money out to make a profit. Otherwise, you know, if they've got the $50 million sitting there and they're paying interest on it, although these days they're not paying too much, but they still have to come up with the money for that interest somewhere. So they make loans. They loan out for cars. They loan out for houses. Well, there's only so many housing loans that they can give before they run out of the amount of money that they can actually loan, because they've only got $50 million sitting there. And if you think about the value of how much money do you have in the bank? Well, I have, I don't know, I've got $7,000 in the bank. And how much money did you take as a loan from the bank for your house? Well, $100,000. Well, where'd that money come from? Well, it came, and Jimmy Stewart's word, it's in John's house, it's in Billy's house, it's... Local banks run out of money to loan if they cannot sell those loans to someone else. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were both created by the government, which is kind of scary in itself, but they were there to create a marketplace for those loans so that you or I or other people could go and make an investment in John's house and in Sally's house and whatever, by buying those loans from an organization that was supposed to be of the highest standards, that could then look at the bank loan and give it a rating and give it a, this is a, put it in a category and say this is a good loan or a bad loan, and that would determine what people were willing to pay for it and so on. If you abolish that, we're back to Jimmy Stewart standing in front of the bank saying, don't take your money out because the bank will go under and no one will be able to buy a house anymore. So people that talk about abolishing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they don't understand that underlying issue, that they have provided something. Now, I mentioned this at the time, just a few minutes ago, when we were talking about they need to be competing against each other.
Well,
they were intended to compete against each other and then almost immediately said, well, no, you don't have to.
I don't think... frankly, the way they were built.
My name is Jake. Not frankly.
Well, the fact is that they worked. Fannie Mae worked quite well.
Yes.
Until the decision was made to deregulate it.
Yep.
And allow it to sell stock and be a privately financed organization.
Correct. I think,
but
it's,
still
it needs
under
to be,
government control.
Right. You can't have one. You can't have both
right
ways. And you have to have government control with regulation,
There's a solution, and this is my opinion, which, by the way, the mortgage companies don't want. The mortgage bankers don't want. It's very simple. Put FDIC, the equivalent of the FDIC, in charge of all mortgage loans.
I think that'd be great. The same way they do with deposits.
Yeah, do it exactly the same way. Now, then you could back off and let the private market handle it, and everything would work reasonably well.
It works really well.
But it would require that anyone offering a mortgage be under the supervision of whatever organization. It, just like a bank, you go to a mortgage broker's office, and it's... The standards there are not anywhere near as high for their behavior and everything else, although they'll tell you otherwise, as if you go to the bank and try to get a loan directly from the bank. It's a different animal altogether. It's run by a different system.
Yeah.
And anybody, not quite anybody, but it's not at all hard to set up a mortgage brokerage office and sell mortgages. And one of the problems you ran into is that those mortgage brokers were not accountable for the quality of mortgage that they sold. Whereas banks weren't.
Yeah, the bank, it's the bank's money. They don't want to give that money to somebody that isn't worthy of it. A mortgage broker, they're not using their own money.
Well, they sell their loans now, too.
Right, they do as well. But there's one extra step between them and the risk at a mortgage brokerage firm, although there's some good regulations there. That what you're talking about federal regulation and having something similar to the FDIC involved, it exists in certain types of mortgage obligations. When you're talking about a VA loan or a low-income housing loan that's federally backed, they have a much stricter set of rules. Anybody
right.
that's ever done a VA loan knows that you mess up on a VA loan and you're not ever doing that again.
And
people can mess up on other mortgages and a couple of years later go back and get a mortgage. But if you mess up on a VA, you're not getting another VA loan.
And for those, and there may be actually somebody listening to the radio at this point, and you may think that,
I'm not.
That you may have heard the propaganda, for lack of better terms, misinformation, that Fannie and Freddie were the cause of the mortgage meltdown and the collapse that we had, or the Community Reinvestment Act or something. Well, let me point out that the mortgage meltdown, real estate collapse in Spain
had nothing to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It
was far, 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 far worse than ours. Spain is still suffering from unemployment rates that are as high as we had in the Great Depression because of the mortgage, the real estate collapse there. They didn't have Fannie Mae, they didn't have Freddie Mac, and they didn't have the Community Reinvestment Act. It happened all over the world.
Yeah, the same thing, if you go back to the 1990s, the same thing happened in Japan. They didn't have Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. We have real estate bubbles and busts. We have bank freezes. And yes, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were completely involved in our disaster. But that's because it was in their industry that the disaster happened, and they had some culpability in our disaster. They did some things that they shouldn't have done, but so did a lot of other people and organizations.
Well, we're going to play some commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back on the other side of these important words from Town Square's sponsors.
I am John Hurt.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Another thing, if we're going to be negative.
Why are we being negative?
Well, no. It used to be at this point in time we would talk about the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average now the Dow is slightly off its record, but the S&P 500 actually broke another record for the end of the week.
Right.
And we could say, whoa, that's really impressive, and we used to talk a lot about that. But, you know, that's true, and it's up there, and that's phenomenal. But the thing that is probably most concerning us, or at least me right now, is the greed factor.
Yep.
At the bottom of the market, the thing that causes people to hurt themselves, and we certainly saw that in 2009, is the fear factor, people bailing out at the bottom. When we've had a run-up, and we technically have a bull market, when we're up more than 20% without a 20% decline in the process, I just read this today in Barron's. I didn't know that was the definition of a bull market, but apparently when the market has risen 20%.
I guess it's the opposite of the bear market. So
without an intervening 20% drop.
Okay.
It's technically a bull market. Who came up with that one? I have no idea. But we are technically now...
Probably somebody at the Guinness Books.
I don't know.
Wandering around saying, well, if it hasn't been up more than 10, but has a down of 5 somewhere in the middle...
Yeah, well, anyway, after drinking a lot of Guinness.
Well, yes. I don't think we should call it a dog market. Dog markets
are... a stout market.
This is a bear market. Bears are much scarier than dogs.
I think it's a stout market.
Right, a stout market.
Right.
Okay. Stout stock.
But we're technically in a bull market. And in a bull market, the thing that destroys portfolios is greed.
Yeah.
And so that's why greed and the greed often is found as people chase higher and higher priced somethings or another. I remember in early 2000, it was either late 1999 or early 2000, it was at a family steakhouse in Kerrville. Was it Kerrville? No, Fredericksburg.
Fredericksburg, yeah.
And there was a ranching family who was sitting there at the table next to us.
A ranching family,
a
yes.
A ranch, clearly agricultural worker family. Good people, looked like, but they had things on their boots that indicated, I mean, the things, the deposits on their boots indicated that they were used to working with livestock. And son says to the father, adult son says to the father, I'm going to get me some more of that Dell stock. You know, it's going to split again, and every time it splits, it goes up. And I looked over at Vicky, and I said, it's over. And she said, my wife, Vicky, and she said, what's over? I said, the bull market is over. It's either at its end or it's about to end. She said, why? And I said, those folks don't know common stock from livestock, because they went on to discuss the fact that stock splitting was like cows having calves. It was just a moneymaker.
Except that's stock
not
splitting.
True. They don't know the difference.
Yeah, stock splitting, by the way, for those of you that don't understand this, is if you
it's
have
a long time since we've seen a lot of stock splitting.
Yeah. If you have a dollar price stock and the stock splits to two for
shares.
One, then you'll have two shares. So you've got a dollar in your hand and a stock valued at a dollar, and it's
right.
One stock. And they come to you and you say, okay, we're going to do a trade. We're going to give you two stock shares instead of one. And they're going to be worth 50 cents a piece.
Well, what happened is people were buying.
How does that make money?
Particularly back then, people tend to buy shares, and it was less expensive to buy shares back then, in lots of 100. Well, it was less. You'd spend less. You could buy a lot of 100 shares for less money, half the money. You know, if it's $5 a share, for example, you can buy 100 shares for $500.
And that's, by the way, the reason why people in companies, they say, we're going to do a stock split, because our stock prices are making it hard for people to buy
yeah.
our stocks. If you think of Berkshire Hathaway.
They don't do splits.
They don't do splits. They're really, really expensive to buy one share, and people go, well, I'm just going to have to buy a fraction of a share. And they used to not even allow fractional shares. They just say you can't have part of a share. But now you can have parts of shares. It's fine now.
And by the way, the reason that Berkshire Hathaway, the reason Warren Buffett has never wanted to do a split is because if you're a small investor, you're going to tend to jump in and jump out and not know what you're doing, and he does not want the volatility. And by the way, there is a definite correlation between the lower the price of a stock, the more volatile it is.
Yeah, because anybody can buy it. And this is a good one. My wife, before we were married, was telling me about her online trading account.
She was your wife before you were married?
She is my wife. Before she was married, though, she wasn't my wife.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Yes, but your wife before we were married.
Right. Yes. It's a very strange concept, but yes.
I just messed you up.
She had just a couple hundred dollars in her online trading account, and she did it because somebody told her that it's a good idea to trade stocks because you can make money in stocks. And so she put a couple hundred dollars, and over probably 2 or 3 year period, that got winnowed down to about $50.
Mm-hmm.
As usually happens when people think that the way you make money in stocks is by doing a lot of trading. What happens is that you do a lot of trading, and there's transaction costs that take place every time. And even if you make money on the number, the stock number, you know, was $5, now it's $6, I'm selling it, you probably lost money on the trade. So
yeah.
Anyway, she successfully managed her stock account into a lot less money than it was before.
That goes with the old saw about how you
make a small fortune in the market.
You start with a large one.
Right.
Right.
And that is, for many people, that's the way it goes, because they think that that's how you invest. And Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett have made a point of saying that's not how you invest. You buy and hold, and you don't get in and out and try to make money on the difference in numbers. Mm-hmm. You make money on the profitability of the company that you own. And that makes a lot of sense to me.
One of the reasons I wanted to bring this up is because apparently there has been a lot of pitching. We were talking about that earlier.
Pitching, yes.
Pitching, selling of closed-end funds by stockbrokers. I guess they're getting desperate because at least Barron's had some comments about this, noting that and closed-end funds are very different from open-end mutual funds, by the way. Closed-end funds trade moment to moment, just like stocks. And they rise and they fall according to what people are willing to pay for them. Whereas a regular, what's called open-ended mutual fund, only trades at the end of the day.
And they're based on the value of everything.
Right.
If they own a bunch of stocks, then the mutual fund's worth the stocks that it owns,
right.
not its own price.
And it isn't, the price is not generated by how many people want to buy it or how many people want to sell it. Well, closed-end funds are different. And they have what's called, they either have premiums or discounts. And
just like stocks do.
In the recent past, apparently, particularly municipal funds, have had some pretty good premiums on them.
So people municipal bond funds?
Municipal bond funds. They buy them because of their tax-free interest.
Mm-hmm.
And they people have thought, boy, this is really great, and we'll buy this, and we'll buy that. And they did those. Well, it's an interesting thing. You know, yes, municipal bonds have fallen, depending on which one you're in. How much they've fallen, there isn't a broad number that represents this. But
it's not a really good index because it's based on municipalities, which by definition don't have
a
lot of diversification there in one spot.
But this is an interesting point. You know, like Facebook, since the IPO has dropped 20%, and that was considered to be horrible.
Horrible.
It's just a terrible thing. But let's just take Eaton Vance Municipal Income Term Fund. Which is a closed-end fund.
We're just
going to
use it
fund.
Kind of as a big over the area.
And its symbol is ETX. It also went public recently in March at $20 and immediately jumped to 4.7% above the value of the underlying bonds because people really said municipal bonds, that's cool. We'll
bonds.
Get a lot of that.
Oh, yes.
And it has now fallen 26% as of Thursday.
So I don't hear a lot of people yelling, well, somebody did the underwriting of this was, or what's going on, and the IPO was wrong, or
and
people should be fired.
Buying what is, quote, going up often can be the worst thing you can do. And it's a hard lesson to learn. I still think it was really appropriate. You mentioned earlier that Chairman Bernanke says I'm not a qualified financial advisor.
It's absolutely true. Good stuff.
So the point is that there are things out there that can create a lot of headaches in your portfolio, and knowing what you're doing and doing it consistently over a long period of time is a very, very critical issue. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, by the way. Our telephone numbers have not changed. 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400.
Man, when you said at the beginning of the show that we got to talk for 2 hours, you weren't kidding.
No, it's the dog days of summer. This happens every summer, right in the middle of July. The hottest days of the year, we sit and we talk to each other. And it's horrible torture. We have father and son have to sit and talk to each other. It's a horrible
thing.
With
other people listening.
Oh,
maybe,
yes.
But we don't know. We don't know if they're listening or not. You know?
I just assume no one's listening.
There's a fascinating thing that if John Templeton were around today, he would be pounding the table and telling people about it every opportunity. He would say, we are headed for a massive bull market in stocks. The Wilshire 5000...
which didn't even exist when he was really around in the stocks.
Towards the end. At one time, had 7,000. It's designed to mimic the entire stock market, the Wilshire 5,000 index. When they opened it, they called it the 5,000 index because there were only 5,000 stocks in the market, which, by the way, compares to like 35,000 mutual funds, which really gets interesting if you'll think about it. Okay, so you got 5,000 stocks in the domestic U.S. market, big to small. So it was called the Wilshire 5,000, and they would own all of them. And on two occasions, in 2007 and before that in 2000, The number got up to around 7,000. So the Wilshire 5,000 had 7,000 stocks in it. That means that there's a lot of supply in the supply and demand chain. And when there's too much supply and not enough demand, the bottom falls out. And believe it or not, John Templeton said that was the best way to tell if the market was high or low is look at the number of stocks available on the New York Stock Exchange. The more stocks there were, the higher the market was and more likely it was to fall. Well, guess how many stocks there are today in the Wilshire 5,000?
5,000.
Four.
There's four stocks?
No, 4,000 stocks.
Oh. Well, that's why they call it Wilshire 5,000 then.
There's only 4,000 stocks, roughly, in the Wilshire 5,000 today. John Templeton would point at that and said, man, have we got a bull market coming, because at the top of the market, the market will run up until it gets about 7,000 stocks in there, and it will fall to about 3,000 or 4,000, which is where it is now, and it will rise again. I just thought that was really a fascinating item. It was in a story that had almost nothing to do with that I got out of, it's a fund of information out of Barron's, and it's actually over the Dell buyout or non-buyout. It may or may not be happening, depending on which is going on, which, again, is one of those really ironic. It's really ironic. The Dell stock came public in the 1980s, and boomed into 2000. And now the vultures are fighting over whether it's worth $13.65 or $14 a share.
Right.
And that is a fascinating thing in and of itself. Basically, and I still think to this day, the irony is that Michael Dell said to Steve Jobs when he was asked about what he would do if he had Apple, he said, I would basically sell it and give the money back to the
shareholders,
which is what he's proposing to do.
With Dell. I mean, at least he's being consistent.
Yes, he's saying basically our company is in the pits.
And I need to get more control than I would with less focus on this year's profits and more on next year's profits.
One of the things that Dell did that I think is fascinating, Dell kept splitting the stock to get small buyers to buy the stock.
And which is the problem right now.
And Apple hasn't done that, except on rare occasion. And so they've got very high dollar per share values in Apple. When you look at the dollar amount that it takes to buy an individual share. Just one of those really, Jeff thinks, fascinating things. You know, for instance, the more companies there are with high dollar value per share, the more stable the market is.
Yeah.
And the more room it has to grow and be a healthy market.
And
the more shares, the more companies there are that people like that have low dollars per share, the more unstable the market is and the more likely it is to fall.
You mentioned this a minute ago, but it's a very important factor here. The number of publicly traded stocks out there, the number has dropped. Companies have gone out of business and new ones haven't gone public. That isn't because some fundamental thing has changed in the way we do business. Anytime somebody says some fundamental change has happened in, it's different this time, that's not true. Technology changes, but how we think and how we go about our day-to-day lives and what motivates us, that doesn't change. That's something that's been true with us since the beginning. And in a case where the number of publicly traded companies has dropped so drastically, now it's possible that regulation could have something to do with that. There's a lot of other things involved, but people still know that that's the leading way, that's the best way to get an influx of money to expand your business is to sell it openly lots of people.
The people who do that are investment banks, and they're in short supply.
Exactly. Real thing. The investment banks have gone under. They're the ones that were most hurt from this.
But this, John Templeton had an interesting theory about the market, and whatever you think about the logic of the theory, and most people don't understand logic of theory about market anyway. But the point is, he simply said that stocks are just a commodity. And they're subject to supply and demand like anything else.
Yep.
And when there is a low demand for stocks and there's too many stocks, a lot of stocks will disappear. A lot of stocks will be taken private, which is what Dell's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said when the demand returns, and it will return, typically when interest rates do what they're doing right now.
Go up.
That they, when there's a shortage of stocks, people will bid up the price of the stocks simply because it's
there's
a supply,
not a lot of them.
It's
yeah.
a supply and demand issue. And they want to buy. They come to the conclusion that holding bonds is no longer a good idea. They now want to hold stocks.
And there's less stocks than there used to be, yep. so the and prices go up faster.
He explained the great bull market that began in about 1982 time frame, coming primarily from the fact that there was a shortage of stocks. And people were leaving bonds behind as they left the Great Depression behind in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
They were leaving bonds, and there was more money available as people became more prosperous, and they put their money into stocks.
And what you were saying, the other side of this is that when we look, well, I remember this in 2007, 2006, we were looking at the number of mutual funds, the number of stocks out there, and there were just so many, it was hard to track. And you look at them now, and there's a lot less. I'm going to have to go back and do some research.
Yeah.
At the number of companies that just don't exist in a publicly traded form anymore.
But there's and Dell is kind of the poster child for that. It's not a matter, is Dell going to...
It's not bankrupt.
But it's not a matter, is Dell going to stay public or not public? It's a matter of who is going to take it private and
right.
take it off the market.
Right.
It'll,
and one side's
won't
saying...
be in the market anymore.
I realize that he's offering you more money than I'm offering you, but he's not offering you enough money. And but I might raise my price possibly if you.
Yeah, it's.
It's a very interesting scenario going on.
Yeah, it is, and I'm not sure that I understand half of it. But
which half is it that you understand? Because I don't think I understand the other half.
I don't understand half of it. The other one I'm completely clueless about.
So, well, one half I don't understand. The other half I'm completely clueless about. Yes.
So let's go in closing the show out. This is the Personal Wealth Coach.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to say this, and this is the 20th of July, the middle of the dog days of summer. An interesting one last thing I wanted to comment. You know, we said earlier that the buy in May, the sell in May and go away.
Right.
And of course, the bottom fell out of the market immediately. But
It's come back.
But the point is that, as we said in May, before the market started to fall, the market's undervalued. A lot of people didn't agree with us. We've said that quite a few times recently.
The market being the stock market, not the bond market.
Right.
Bond market's overvalued still.
And now the stock market has come back. And I just wanted to say that if you hold a portfolio and you've got it well diversified and you look at some asset class in there other than bonds that is dropped, take a hard look at it and think about it and don't say, okay, that's a bad thing, I need to get rid of it. There's a real tendency to do that. Say, okay, has this become less valuable or has it just gotten more underpriced?
Right.
And if it's become more underpriced, then hang on to it. So that's kind of my guidance for the week.
Yes. So this has been the Personal Wealth Coach, and we actually give advice on portfolios for a living as well as doing it for free on the radio.
We manage portfolios. Can you believe that?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So if you'd like to contact us off the air, if you've got a portfolio that you think you need some help with, you can call us. Voicemail's waiting over the weekend. We do actually have live people that answer the phone during the week. But if you would like to contact us voicemail locally.
947. Now, this is a hard number to remember. 947-1111. And
okay.
The reason we got that number, I got that number personally so I could remember it.
I don't remember it. I just don't just say
See,
call
Jake,
us.
Jake See, can remember the 800 number, but I can't.
If you call 1-800-914-7526, that's 800-914-PLAN. You will also get the same voicemail, and somebody will get back to you. You can also email us, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and send us an email. We actually use those as fodder for the show. You can also go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, or our test page right now is tpwc.com.
Why do you keep using TPWC?
It's not just a word. On
all right.
Your Fox
we'll be back
station.
Next week with more of TPWC.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.